Welcome to Time Team News, our new monthly feature bringing you all the latest archaeology stories and discoveries from Britain and across the globe. Our first story takes us to Nordlingen, an ancient town in Bavaria in southeast Germany. Now, some of you may recognise its terracotta rooftops from the closing act of the film Willy Wonka and his Chocolate Factory from 1971. But this summer, it was the scene of some incredible archaeological discoveries, burials dating back some 3,400 years to the Bronze Age in the 14th century BC. The finds include an incredibly intact bronze sword, which apparently hasn't been used and it is in an incredible state of preservation. Professor Matthias Feil, head of the Bavarian State Department of Monuments and Sites, said the state of preservation is extraordinary. During the European Bronze Age, there were many different types of swords, but this particular sword is characterised by its octagonal hilt or handle. And this particular type of swords, the ones with the octagonal handles, are found predominantly in South Germany and also a bit further north in the area that's now North Germany and Denmark. The surface of the sword has a vibrant green patina. Now, this has developed on the surface over time due to the copper content of the metal. But originally, the sword would have had a highly polished, dazzling bronze finish. But what's great about this isn't the fact that it's just a very well-preserved sword. You can see the skill that's gone into making something like that. But it's actually the fact that it's been discovered in situ, in context. So we've got the original owners there with it, and we can see how it relates to other artifacts as well. One of the things that archaeologists will be able to do is metallurgical analysis on the bronze. So bronze is made of tin and copper predominantly. And so hopefully they'll be able to trace where these raw materials have come from originally. And that gives us a window in to things like the trade of raw materials, the movement of artifacts and of people. So it's a fantastic opportunity to be able to find out more about how people lived in the Middle Bronze Age. The sword was found as part of a burial containing the skeletons of an adult female, male, and a youth. Now, because the excavations are relatively recent, it's not yet known how the three people were related or if indeed they were. Hopefully, further research will be able to tell us more about this. Also, there were other finds discovered, such as bronze arrowheads and other artifacts. Now, whilst the sword is the immediate eye-catching find, post-excavation analysis of the skeletons, the finds, and the environmental sampling will eventually provide us with a fuller picture of just who these three people were and the times in which they lived. What an intriguing discovery. We look forward to keeping an eye on this story to see how it develops. First up, we're off to Cerne Abbas, a village in Dorset in southwest England. Once described as Britain's most desirable village, it's most famous for its giant chalk figure carved into the hillside. Originally believed to be ancient, possibly prehistoric, recent research by the National Trust and Partners has established that this giant can't have been carved before 700 AD, making it late Anglo-Saxon, early medieval in date. Nevertheless, the area is steeped in history. Now, our story begins at the foot of the hill, where archaeologists from the University of Sheffield, led by Dr. Hugh Wilmot, have relocated the Benedictine Abbey that was lost during the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. The abbey itself has a fascinating history. It was built well before the Norman conquest and actually suffered a raid under King Canute in the early 11th century, before going on to become a major monastic complex. Lawrence has been out in the field to take a look.
Thank you, Danny. Well, I'm here in Dorset and I popped out to meet Hugh. Talk us through what you're up to.
Well, we have stood on the walkway of the cloister. And we're excavating part of the cloister of the monastery and a little bit of the church as well.
So we're looking for a monastery and an abbey here.
Yes.
What drew you here in the first place?
Well, Everyone knew there was an abbey here in the Middle Ages, but when it was closed down, it kind of disappeared off the map a bit. So its precise location wasn't known and quite what its sort of layout was. So last year we did a geophysical survey and got some amazing results. So we're now following that up with some excavation.
Fantastic. So we're on week three. Why don't you talk us through what some of the things you found and some of the highlights?
Well, over in that part of the site, we've got the open cloister. It's like the sort of open garden area. And that linked up many of the main buildings of the Abbey complex. And then where we're stood at the moment is actually in the Abbey walkway, which was a covered walkway that ran around the outside of the garden and would have had an arcade with sort of open arches. Sometimes they were glazed so you could look out onto the garden. I mean, although it's been thoroughly demolished, there's all sorts of fragments of architecture and detail that help us, you know, reconstruct its appearance. So we've got bits of moulded columns, we've got painted window glass, we've got the floor tiles. So, you know, putting them all together, it gives us a really, you know, really vivid impression of the building at its height.
Oh, look at that. That's spectacular.
Yep, this is an in-situ section of church floor.
So why don't you use that sponge and just tidy it up? I bet they cut really nicely.
Yeah, go on, give it a go. Oh.
Not done this before. I've never cleaned a medieval floor before. Oh, look at that. The colour's really coming up when you get that.
Absolutely.
Isn't that beautiful? Oh, this is really special.
It is. It's not often that you get to do that.
Hugh, we've got a great selection of the incredible masonry that you found in your trenches. The standout piece is this bit right in front of you here. What have we got?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what it is. I mean, it's from a fixture or fitting in the church. You know, it's not a sort of large monumental piece of architecture. If you imagine it the other way up, it looks like a sort of support or like a little shelf, perhaps for a statue or, you know, for something else to sit on in a very prominent location.
Fantastic. Well, here's hoping you find plenty more things like this.
Absolutely.
Archaeological discoveries can be made in all kinds of different ways. And with this next example in the news, it was actually the weather. A landslide, likely caused by a fire in northwest Spain, brought an exquisite find to the surface, a beautiful gold torque, provisionally dated to 2,500 years old. It was found by a worker for a water company while carrying out a survey of the land, and he immediately notified archaeologists. And fragments of a second torque were then subsequently found in the area following further investigation. Torques are a type of rigid necklace, frequently made of gold, and they're often made of strands of gold twisted around each other, which is where we get the word torque, meaning twisted in Latin. They were worn by people during the European Iron Age and into the Roman period. And they are serious bling. Not everyone would have owned an item like this, and so they're most likely worn as a symbol of status. There's a famous sculpture of the dying Gaul wearing a torque, and several torques are also depicted on the famous gunstruck cauldron that was discovered back in 1891 in Denmark. Torques have been found all across Europe in a wide range of styles, some with elaborate looped terminals like those in the Snettisham Hoard in East Anglia, or what's known as buffer terminals in Gaul, modern France. The newly discovered examples from northern Spain are particularly indicative of the style found around the North Iberian Peninsula, with terminals that resemble a candlestick holder. The wider region of what is now northwest Spain was once home to a range of different tribes, including the Cantabri and the Asturias, names that are still evident in local place names, including the University of Cantabria that has been involved in the discovery. Although many ancient torques have been found previously, a large number of these were antiquarian discoveries, which generally place less value on the archaeological contexts than the finds themselves. So their original context either wasn't recorded or it's simply been lost to time. This new discovery is particularly important because it's got the potential to provide valuable information about the archaeological context in which the torque was discovered. Of course, it's the gold jewellery that makes the headlines. But for me, it's the story of the people behind it that's most compelling and fascinating. These beautifully constructed items highlight the sophistication of the culture that made them. While there's so much archaeology in the UK, amazing discoveries are being made all across the world. Ongoing research is helping to shed new light on ancient humans in what is now the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. One of our Patreon members, Bill Erickson, says, "I'd love to see mention of the dig sites in Oregon and Idaho, extending back the time of humans in North America." Well, thank you, Bill, for that suggestion. Archaeologists from the University of Oregon have been excavating the site of a Rimrock Draw rock shelter near the city of Burns in Oregon since 2011, led by Dr. Patrick O'Grady. Now, because they're in the final stages of the fieldwork phase of the project, they haven't yet published the final results in an academic publication, but what they have done is produce some preliminary findings. Amongst many of the artefacts excavated at the site, there are ancient bison teeth, and there's also a tooth from a camelops, which is an extinct type of prehistoric camel that once roamed the area. And in the same area, there were two prehistoric worked tools known as scrapers made from orange agate. Now, archaeologists often talk about stratigraphy, which is the build-up of layers over time, representing different phases of activity. Now, what's interesting here is that the teeth and these two stone tools were recovered from underneath a layer of volcanic ash. Now, this volcanic ash came from one of the eruptions of Mount St. Helens, which occurred around 15,000 years ago. So that means that the teeth and the tools have to be older than 15,000 years because they were underneath this layer of volcanic ash, which is astounding. But what surprised the researchers even more is that since then, they've done radiocarbon dating on the bison teeth and on the camel tooth. And this has pushed the date of the site back even further to 18,250 years ago. Now, because of the presence of the tools at the site, this suggests that humans were present there all that time ago, around 18,000 years ago, making this potentially one of the earliest sites in North America. We look forward to hearing further developments on this research. It's always exciting following in the footsteps of our forebears, but thanks to discoveries in neighbouring Lake County, Oregon, we can actually trace their footwear too. Many sandals have been found at dry cave sites in Oregon's northern Great Basin in and around Fort Rock. The sandals have been expertly woven out of sagebrush bark and are incredibly well preserved. Many can be seen at Oregon's Museum of Natural and Cultural History, and some of the pairs have been radiocarbon dated and shown to be around 10,000 years old, making them the world's oldest footwear. Meanwhile, the start of summer can only mean one thing: archaeological field schools. Field schools are an excellent opportunity for students and volunteers to hone their archaeological excavation techniques and recording skills. Derek has been out in the beautiful Dorset countryside visiting Bournemouth University's field school, so let's see what he's been up to.
Thanks, Danny. Archaeological field schools are one of the most important parts of the archaeological process in the UK. And I'm in Winterbourne, Kingston in Dorset on the site of the Duratriges Big Dig with my friend, colleague and long-time Time Team regular Miles Russell to talk about what he's been up to in the field with our Bournemouth University students. Miles, what have you been up to the last few weeks?
The last six weeks we've been excavating a large late Iron Age settlement. So this is what's known as a banjo enclosure. It's an elite farmstead, really existed about about 300 to 100 BC. We've got storage pits everywhere. We've got round houses. We've got Iron Age burials. And we've got evidence of a lot of earlier activity going on as well from the early Bronze Age. So quite a lot.
Amazing. So what sort of things have our students been up to this year?
Well, our students have really, they're essentially their training course. So learning how to detect, how to record features, how to excavate and sample. So most of them have been investigating these storage pits, which are the central sort of, storage facility of the Iron Age settlement. Much of them just contain soil, but what we're finding at the bottom of a lot of these pits is just before they were backfilled, there's some sort of ritual deposit going in. So in some cases, it's dog burials. In other cases, it's complete stacks of pottery. One or two examples have had human remains and some sort of cut up remains of horse and cow. But it seems to be some kind of ritual deposit, perhaps a thank you to the gods of the land after a successful harvest. But pretty much every pit has got something like this right at the bottom of it.
That's really interesting. But any particularly special finds this year?
We've had a lot. I mean, this has been very good for domestic evidence. We've had lots of evidence of weaving. We've had large triangular loom weights. We've had spindle whirls. We had weaving combs. So as far as textile manufacturing goes, there's a lot of evidence for that. But as far as burial evidence, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic because this is one of the few parts of Iron Age Britain where we know that the local communities buried their dead in recognisable cemeteries. So it sounds a bit ghoulish, but it's the finding of human remains, which for us is the real treasure, because it's the one part of Britain in the pre-Roman Iron Age where we can identify individuals, look at diseases, look at the cause of death, look at dietary isotopes, and really get detailed information about the people. So from that, that's pure gold to us.
Brilliant. Thank you, Miles.
This year marks the 400th anniversary of William Shakespeare's First Folio. And it's thanks to this landmark publication that we've got so many of Shakespeare's works today. But Shakespeare has been in the news recently for other reasons. A historic theatre in Norfolk has recently uncovered 15th century floorboards that were once trodden by Shakespeare himself. Helen has been along to investigate the boards of the Bard.
Tim, I'm Helen.
Hi.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
I recognise you from the paper boat at Queenborough, don't I?
Yes, that was a very exciting time, team, a long time ago.
Yes,
very
yes.
Wet and salty fish, I remember.
Yes,
a lot of that.
But you've dried out now.
I have dried out, yes, and we're now inside. So there's no river danger, hopefully, today.
Well, we are inside, aren't we? But yeah. I was expecting a medieval guild hall. I wasn't expecting a fully functioning theatre to be here.
No. Well, I mean, we call it the oldest working theatre in the country. And the reason for that is that we've got recorded drama happening in this venue in the 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 1900s, and now, of course, in the 2000s today.
But what's the connection with Shakespeare?
Well, it's pretty strong. We have the corporation account books, which show a payment going from the Corporation of King's Lynn to William Shakespeare's company at the time, the Earl of Pembroke's men, in 1592-93. So we know that his company was paid to turn up. We know that Shakespeare was on stage in that period because he got a bad review, the Upstart Crow review written by Robert Greene. So it refers to Shakespeare as a player rather than as a writer. So we've got the idea that he's on stage in those years as well. Shakespeare's comedian, Robert Armin, was born in King's Lynn, just literally one street away from this venue. And Armin created all the really weird and funny parts, the fool in King Lear, the porter in the Scottish play. And we've still got features that Shakespeare would have seen when he came here. You know, the seats wouldn't have been here quite clearly in this arrangement. But we've got this fantastic scissor brace ceiling that Shakespeare would have seen, would have known. We've got the windows all still here that he would have seen and would have known. We've now got another exciting find about something Shakespeare would have known really well when he came to the venue. And it's just down there.
Can you show me?
Yeah.
Great. What is this hole in the floor?
So we've got some Towns Fund money, which is we're trying to spend to do up the theatre and renovate it. We're working in partnership, the Borough of King's Lynn, with the National Trust. And as part of that, we were able to pay an archaeologist team to come and do a massive survey of the venue.
So this is a kind of trial trench.
This is a trial trench, exactly right. So it's a 1 metre square, give or take, trench, so that we could try and test that what we hoped might be there.
This
was
is, in fact,
there.
This is a test pit.
It is a test pit.
In a floor, it in is. A theatre.
Yeah.
Upstairs.
Yeah. That's right. Well, archaeology isn't just about going underground. You can go through layers of buildings and still get archaeological information. And that's really what we've done here. And what we found underneath here is the original floor.
So what are we seeing here? This is a joist for this floor.
That's right, the 1950s floor.
Then
we're not sure how old this one is yet, but we do know that it's either 18th century or conceivably early 19th century. It's obviously older than the 1950s floor. And then below that, you've got the real prize, which is this original guild floor from 1417, 1420. So these are the boards on which Shakespeare would have performed in 1592, 93 when he came to play in King's Lynn. So these are the boards on which the bard trod. So when we say we're treading the boards with Shakespeare, we mean the actual boards here, which is really exciting.
So this would have been about 170 years old when Shakespeare came to perform in this space.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That is phenomenal.
I mean, it's really exciting, isn't it? Yeah. And what's really exciting about it is we think this is generally the area that Shakespeare would have been performing in the venue itself. Down there, like that. Mind your fingers.
Yep.
There we go.
The thing that's occurring to me, though, now is that you and your parents and all the people who are getting ready for tonight's performance, they are performing in a space with the same roof, etc. Everything that Shakespeare would have seen. Yeah. You're in the same place as Shakespeare acted.
Yeah.
That's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah, no,
it
really is. Yeah. I mean, there isn't another place like it I can't think of another theatre that's still working that can say, oh, yeah, no, we've had Shakespeare here.
Please do look out for our extended coverage over on Patreon.
Yeah. This is the ceiling of the floor below, and of course it's the floor above.
We're going to be exploring stories from around the globe, so my next item stems from the Shaanxi province of north central China during the Shang Dynasty. The Shang Dynasty ruled in the Bronze Age between the 16th to the 11th centuries BC, so it's broadly contemporary with the Nord Lingen sword, dating to around 3,000 years ago. Its capital was Yingsu, an area well known for its archaeology, but these finds come from a new site 350 miles to the east near the banks of the Yellow River. The impressive scale of this site suggests that it was an important regional power base. Structures and features uncovered so far include many buildings made of rammed earth, a traditional building technique, cemeteries and workshops for casting bronze. According to a statement from the Shaanxi Academy of Archaeology, preliminary work has revealed the highly developed bronze civilization that existed in northern Shaanxi during the late Shang Dynasty, one which was closely related to the Yingsu culture, far exceeding previous understanding. The Academy has shared a range of stunning finds, many of which are highly decorative personal items, such as this turquoise and bronze bird ornament. The array of finds that have been discovered demonstrate the various skills that are being used and also the different types of material that are being worked. For example, intricate carvings in jade and bone, gold earrings and fine lacquer work. World news now, and this takes us to Kalambo Falls in Zambia in South Central Africa. Kalambo Falls is the second largest waterfall in Africa, and it's long been of interest to archaeologists due to the Stone Age activity in the area. An international team of archaeologists have uncovered what's thought to be the earliest example of a wooden structure intentionally made by humans. This simple structure takes the form of two shaped pieces of timber that have been modified to slot together with a notch system. Now, the level of preservation is amazing because it was found in waterlogged conditions, and the team have been able to conduct a sophisticated dating technique known as optically stimulated luminescence. And the date that's come back is 476,000 years ago. This pushes the findings way back to a time that predates anatomically modern humans. Another technique, infrared spectroscopy, suggests that fire might have been used to help to make the notch in the wood. Now, this suggests that our early hominid forebears were using fairly complicated techniques, and that challenges our existing ideas of early human development. The findings were published in Nature by the universities Liverpool, Aberystwyth, Royal Holloway, Algarve and Liège, the British Museum and the National Museums Board, Zambia. Now, we caught up with the lead author, Professor Barham from the University of Liverpool, and it turns out he's no stranger to Time Team. He featured in our episode Caves of the Cheddar Gorge way back in Series 6. Now, of the Calambre Falls, Professor Barham wrote to Time Team to say, "This find has changed how I think about early ancestors. Forget about the label Stone Age. Look at what these people were doing. They made something new and large from wood. They had the tools for the job and they used their intelligence, imagination and skills to create something they'd never seen before. They transformed their surroundings to make life easier, even if it was only making a platform to sit on by the river to do their daily chores. These folks were more like us than we thought." And if you'd like to find out more about this discovery, there's a link to the academic journal published in Nature in the description box below. Next up, a prehistoric complex on the outer reaches of the British Isles. The Ness of Brodgar is one of many ancient sites on Orkney, a cluster of islands off the northeast tip of Scotland. Orkney is a wild, rugged landscape and it's home to some awe-inspiring archaeology. It was granted World Heritage Site status by UNESCO in 1999. Now, we've had quite a few requests about this one. For example, Katie Brown said, "Please talk about the Ness of Brodgar." Well, as it happens, Time Team's John Gator was there this summer. In fact, it's a site close to his heart because he discovered it some 20 years ago whilst undertaking a geophysical landscape survey across Orkney.
As we expanded the survey, I started to realise they weren't geological responses. They were actually archaeological responses and something on a scale, I think it's fair to say, I'd never seen before.
What they discovered turned out to be a major Neolithic complex of international importance.
I've been doing archaeological geophysics for some nearly 50 years now, and I think I have to say discovering the Ness of Brodgar has to be the main highlight of my career.
The site of the Ness of Brodgar stems back to the Neolithic, about 5,000 years ago. So it's broadly contemporary with Stonehenge. But never mind about Stonehenge, because Orkney has some of its own spectacularly impressive stone circles. The Ring of Brodgar and the Stones of Stenness. Now, the Ness of Brodgar lies almost equidistant between the two stone circles on a thin sliver of land between two lochs. The site shares some similarities with nearby Skara Brae, although the structures at the Ness of Brodgar are larger and more complex. The excavations are run by the Ness of Brodgar Trust in conjunction with the UHI Archaeology Institute, led by site director Nick Card. I love the sense of community that you get with this project, bringing together archaeologists and volunteers both locally and across the globe. Over the years, they've uncovered all sorts of interesting finds, including these highly polished carved stone balls, which are characteristic of the region. Intricately decorated examples of these stone balls have been found all across Orkney, but nobody really knows what they were used for. It remains a mystery at the moment, although there are lots of ideas. What do you think they were used for? Let us know in the comments section below. Other finds include polished stone axes, stone spatulas, painted masonry and enigmatic engravings carved into stone. Visitors are welcome during the summer season and 2024 is the last year of excavation before they start working on the post-excavation analysis and on publication. The project is mainly supported by the public and you can get involved by having a look at the Ness of Brodgar project webpage and we'll put a link in below. And as John will attest, it's a project well worth supporting.
To see the results of Nick's 20 years work at the site, I was overwhelmed. It was quite an emotional moment, something I'll never forget.
So, you mentioned the Pacific. We have to come back to it. tell me about this holiday you had.
Holiday, how dare you? So it was a genuine piece of research. We were very fortunate. It's a collaborative project between the University of Highlands and Islands, Bournemouth University, archaeologists in Auckland and heritage specialists on the islands themselves in the South Pacific. And what we were doing, we were working through funding from the Arcadia Foundation, and we were looking to map and record endangered cultural heritage, archaeological sites that perhaps are under threat from climate change specifically. So increased storiness, rising sea levels, things like that.
That sounds really interesting, but also a truly international team.
Yeah, and it's really important with these sorts of projects to make sure that we're working with the islanders themselves. It's not about a case of a bunch of Europeans turning up and telling them how to look after their archaeology, but actually they know what their heritage is, they know what's important to them, and we needed them to talk us through what's going on and what we needed to record. So we visited two countries. We worked in Niue, and we also worked in the Cook Islands. We visited two islands in the Cook Islands. We were in Rarotonga and in Aachu, and we just saw the most fantastic array of archaeological sites, from early Maori settlers, burial caves, these sort of stone structures known as marae, which are the meeting points where they sort of tribal leaders would undertake ceremonies, but also more modern history, things that were really pertinent to them. So some of the oldest sort of Christian churches that were found on the island and that had been damaged by quite severe cyclones over time. So we were able to do 3D recording, mapping and things like that with the archaeology.
Now, one of the pictures you sent me was you hacking at bushes with a machete. Can you tell me, what were you looking for then, and what did you find?
Well, I mean, it's not like forestry in the UK, I'll tell you that, Derek. It's the rate of growth and the density of vegetation on these tropical islands, these subtropical islands, is just incredible. It's warm, it's wet, it's perfect for growth. And as a result, a lot of the archaeology and a lot of it, I mean, most of it we're looking in the last 1,000 years or so, is no longer where habitation is taking place. So it's deep in the forest and it's been grown up, it's grown up over a lot of time. So to get to a lot of it, which probably hasn't been looked at since the 1980s in the most recent times, is actually you've got to get a machete and you've got to get out and you've got to go looking for it. You've got to reveal it and watch out for spiders and crabs and sea snakes in some instances. But it was an absolute pleasure. It's the sort of thing you dream of doing as an undergraduate, but also to be welcomed and supported and embraced by local communities and to learn so much from them about their cultural heritage. It was an absolute privilege and honour to be able to be there.
This next story was suggested by one of our Patreon members, Joanne Kellum, and it's about AI, or artificial intelligence, being used to decipher some ancient papyrus scrolls. A researcher from the University of Kentucky has joined forces with a couple of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to launch the Vesuvius Challenge, a competition that harnesses machine learning technology to reveal the contents of ancient scrolls, and big prizes are being offered to those who can do it. You may have heard of the devastating eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79 that engulfed the towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum under metres of ash and mud. During the 1750s, excavations at Herculaneum uncovered a huge palatial villa that was later named the Villa of the Papyri due to the extensive library of scrolls that were discovered there. Due to the heat of the eruption, the scrolls are heavily carbonised, a bit like being baked in a really hot oven, and as such they really easily turn to dust. But over the years there have been all kinds of attempts to unroll them, from cutting them vertically to putting them in a box and covering them in liquid mercury, which ultimately destroyed them. In the 1750s, a Vatican archivist, Father Piaggio, invented a machine which took several years to gradually unroll the scrolls millimetre by millimetre. In 2019, Dr. Brent Seals from the University of Kentucky used a particle accelerator called the Diamond Light Source, one of the most powerful X-ray facilities in the world, to create a 3D scan of the internal structure of a scroll. But in some ways, that was only the beginning, because what you have is a spiral of layers that just creates a mix, a jumble of hundreds of letters. So Dr. Seal and his team have been working on virtually unwrapping the scroll. But it doesn't stop there, because it turns out that the ink that was used to write on the scrolls with is carbon-based, and that doesn't show up very well on the X-rays against the carbonized papyrus. And this is where the Vesuvius Challenge comes in. Contributors are developing AI software to differentiate between the papyrus and the ink, and using machine learning to identify individual letters, which will ultimately lead to revealing full words and sentences. Once it's been revealed, the text will be passed on to ancient Greek scholars for translation. Several prizes have already been awarded. Luke Faritor, a 21-year-old student from the University of Nebraska, won $40,000 when he developed a model that was able to reveal the word porphyrus, an ancient Greek word for purple. Many ancient texts are only known about because they're mentioned in later writings. We don't have the originals. At Herculaneum, there are about 600 scrolls that are unrolled and unread, so it's just possible that we might have, from the Villa of the Papyri, some original ancient texts. And the other exciting prospect is that there are many areas of the Villa of the Papyri that haven't been excavated yet, so there are potentially hundreds more scrolls yet to be discovered. One of the great things about the Vesuvius Challenge is that it's a collaborative interaction between researchers from different backgrounds. It's an open source project where researchers are encouraged to share their findings, processes, and data with each other for the benefit of all. But will the $700,000 grand prize be won for reading four passages of text? We'll have to wait and see. Italian archaeologists have uncovered what they think are the remains of the Roman Emperor Nero's theatre near the Vatican in Rome. Now, whilst it had been mentioned in an ancient text written by Pliny the Elder, the exact location of the theatre was previously unknown, and we hope to bring you more on this in future instalments. Now, from Sherds to the Shard, Roman remains in central London. Development at Southwark has revealed what's been described by the excavators as the most intact Roman mausoleum to be discovered in Britain. London, or Londinium as the Romans called it, was founded by the Romans after the Claudian invasion of AD 43 along the banks of the River Thames, where it became a strategic trading post and a military stronghold. It's not unusual for new developments to reveal glimpses of London's Roman origins. In fact, a whole host have been discovered over the years. But this latest discovery at the Liberty of Southwark is just a stone's throw away from some of London's key landmarks. The excavation was carried out by the Museum of London Archaeology, or MOLA. Senior archaeologist at MOLA, Antonietta Lurs, said it provides a fascinating window into the living conditions and lifestyle of this part of the city in the Roman period. The small mausoleum features a beautiful mosaic which was discovered in situ, and underneath that is another mosaic, so this suggests that the mausoleum has been in use for an extended period of time. According to the statement, the mausoleum may have been used by the wealthier members of society, or it may have even been owned by a burial club where members paid a monthly fee to be buried inside. The developers have said that they are committed to retaining and restoring the mausoleum for public display and enjoyment, to provide a tangible link between the Roman archaeology of Southwark and the site on which the artefacts were found. If you'd like to discover more about Roman London, there are remains hidden in plain sight all around the city. You just have to know where to look. For example, Tower Hill Tube Station. There's a great article on Roman London in the August edition of Current Archaeology, which also just happens to feature Time Team on its cover.
As you know, we like to include ideas suggested by you, and this next site was put forward by Sigturn, so thank you for that. Excavations at Seddin in Brandenburg, northeast Germany, have revealed a humongous Bronze Age hall.
So Derek, how big are we talking?
It was 31 by 10 metres, which is ginormous. In fact, it's one of the largest discovered in the whole region. Arguably, it is the largest Nordic hall of its type.
Wow.
And its huge size indicates that it would have likely been a meeting place presided over by a regional chieftain or king, possibly a ruler known as King Hines around the 10th to 9th century BC. This possible royal connection is supported by its location right next to a tomb that's thought to belong to King Hines, dating to around 850 BC. The hall was constructed out of a timber frame with wattle and daub walls and likely a thatched roof. All organic materials, of course, that rot away. Now, anyone who's ever watched Time Team will know that finding wooden structures is incredibly difficult. Ultimately, you're looking for post holes in the ground. It's a case of joining the dots.
So hang on a minute. When we talk about the Bronze Age, we might traditionally think about small roundhouses, but not big halls.
That's right. In the British Bronze Age, it tends to be fairly small-scale ephemeral structures. You'd associate these kind of great halls more with the medieval period. There is one example, I think, from a site near London, of a Neolithic kind of large-scale house, but nothing quite like this one.
Amazing. So what can we learn from the excavations? What techniques might have been used?
It's a really interesting one. Whenever I see a site like this in the news, I think about Time Team and I think about what we would have done there. So I'm sure they did some geophysical survey and some mapping and looked at the landscape context. I like to imagine a German version of Stu bodging around the landscape, looking for lumps and bumps, seeing what he can see, but also thinking through the excavation itself. Because these structures are so ephemeral, they would have had to find most of the features, I suspect, by direct excavation.
Mm-hmm. I bet the environmental analysis, the sort of work Naomi does as well, would have been fascinating.
Massively. Every little bit of evidence on this site would have been absolutely key to understanding the bigger picture and to link it to that all-important King Hines.
It's funny, actually, I was just thinking back to the first Time Team news and when Danny showcased that incredible Bronze Age sword, and that was from Germany, right?
Yeah, well, that was from a completely different site in Nordlingen, much further south. Although the two stories aren't directly connected, they do stem from broadly the same era around 3,000 years ago. Put together, they help shed light on a really colourful period in the Nordic Bronze Age.
So I'm joined by Professor Carenza Lewis, who's just heard some fantastic news. She's been awarded a British Academy Landscape Archaeology Medal. Carenza, can you tell us a bit more about it? Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I was just absolutely stunned. I mean, it's really prestigious. It's the British Academy. It's their Landscape Archaeology Medal. The other people who've won it are the great and the good. And I was so surprised when I got the email saying congratulations on your award. I assumed it was a scam. It's like those ones that say you've won a prize. Because I didn't know I was up for it or anything. It's a kind of career recognition thing. And it's, you know, it's just lovely. I'm really, really pleased.
Such an amazing, like you say, it really is a prestigious award. Does this involve all the test pitting that you've been doing over the years?
Yes, so I think that's mainly what my work has been over the last 20 years, has been looking at these inhabited villages. So previously when people had looked at medieval settlements, they tended to look at the deserted medieval villages, partly because they're quite intriguing because it's a deserted settlement. It's like finding a dead body ghost village, you know, there's that what happened to it sort of thing. Whereas the 90% of settlements that people lived in the medieval period are still inhabited today. We've done 2,500 test pits in 100 villages, mostly in the UK. I've started extending it over the last few years into the Netherlands, Czech Republic, Poland and Germany.
And in terms of volunteers, 10,000 people, that's an amazing number of people to involve. What kind of benefits do you think people get from being involved in archaeology projects like this?
They just kind of were buzzing. You get these kids who turned up looking bewildered or kind of slightly overcool and self-conscious. And that buzz that they got from it.
Well, you've certainly made a difference. And I'm really glad that you've been recognised by the British Academy for this fantastic British Archaeology Landscape Award. Congratulations, Professor Carenza Lewis.
Thank you very much. And I'm very grateful to the British Academy as well.
Some of our Time Team friends and family, led by our very own Dr. Lawrence Shaw, have been involved in the excavation of a First World War training camp, which was designed to prepare soldiers for the trenches. Let's have a look what they've been up to.
Between 1915 and 1920, hundreds of thousands of troops were based here in Clipston Camp. Lawrence has assembled a team, including people from Forestry England, Operation Nightingale, Nottinghamshire Council, and of course Time Team, to investigate their training area that's been protected by these trees for nearly 100 years.
We've got these beautiful traditional crenellated First World War trenches that most people would recognise. It looks like the top of a castle. But we've also got these slightly different ones with these giant pits with linear connections. And we don't quite understand the difference between those trenches.
We found the natural here.
I personally don't recognise this as a typical type of trenching network.
How's it going in your trench,
mate? Oh, don't stand so close to me. Nothing came up. I think the amount of vegetation here, we're probably looking at a good foot or two before we find the bottom of the trench.
We've got our first artefact.
Fantastic.
The Forest to Frontline project is also delivered in collaboration with the Minor to Major Landscape Partnership project, which is supported by the National Lottery Heritage Fund. And we look forward to following this project in 2024. If you've seen our new Digging Band of Brothers special with Tony Robinson, you'll know all about Operation Nightingale. This Ministry of Defence initiative uses archaeology to support the recovery of servicemen and women returning from conflict. Helen has caught up with Operation Nightingale's co-founder Richard Osgood and photographer Harvey Mills to discover more about their brand new book, Broken Pots, Mending Lives.
Richard, I've been really enjoying your new book, which is just out, isn't it?
Yes, just out this year.
You tell some really personal stories. Did they take a while to get out of people? Or, I mean, I was surprised at how much detail. You know, occasionally I was shedding a tear at the things that people had been through.
It's really interesting, but I wanted it to be about people and those stories of why we're doing this work. The military people tell some, as you say, they're quite harrowing tales, but sometimes it's a positive by the end. And they often take a time to open up to you, because if you're not military, you're not quite part of that tribe. Yeah. But once they know you, after a while, they will open up. And I think that's really important. As you said, they seem to be happy enough, and maybe it's part of their movement forward. When you read their stories and you look at them and you think what they've been through, and you think, I put myself in that and I think, I can't imagine having to do what you've done. And if archaeology can help you, it's quite humbling, really, because I do archaeology because I love it and it's a day job. But for them, if it improves where they are in life, the whole programme is not about creating archaeologists. But we have had quite a few that have now gone on to it. And Kenny, I mentioned, who found the bucket, he's just finished his 10th year as a professional archaeologist. Yeah. So it's not the aim. And I think what we do aim to create is a safer space, one of discovery and making friendships. That's the key thing.
And the good thing is that this is now all in the book. Mm. It's such a fantastic title, Broken Pots, Mending Lives, because archaeology has mended so many lives, whether they've been really shattered or whether they're just slightly off track and you can pull them back again.
In many environments, I think I always joke about the digs being battle honours. If they've done a certain dig, they'll have it as a regiment, you know, their own person. Did you do Barrow Clump, for example?
Yes.
And if you didn't do Barrow Clump, oh, well, you're one of the newbies.
You weren't there.
Exactly, it's all that sort of stuff.
I was at Barrow Clump.
You were Barrow Clump, yeah, exactly.
Only for a few days.
You were definitely there.
And your fantastic photographs, Harvey. What really amazed me was things like, apart from the incredibly atmospheric things like that.
See, there's no filter even on that. Harvey's very particular about not using filters on these, and that's...
But what looked like you've taken them in a studio, you know, something like that. That's so beautifully lit. That's so perfectly suspended in space.
Most of the shots in there are finds and not done in the studio. Most of them are done actually on site. One of the big things for me, certainly with small finds photography, is to try and get it as fresh as I can. But, you know, it's always nice to get conserved pieces, but I think it's also nice just to get things with a bit of mud on them as well.
Well, thank you very much. It's lovely to be able to talk to you about this book, and I hope it sells really well.
Great, because all money to charity.
Oh, right. Yep. Fantastic.
Every penny will go to SAFA, which is the military charity, which has helped out some of our
team. Lovely. Yeah, so if anybody wants to know more about it, there it is. Broken Pots, Mending Lives by Richard Osgood, with all the fantastic photographs taken by Harvey Mills, apart from one by Alice Roberts. Look out for the cartoons by Alice as well. And hopefully in another 10 years, we'll get volume two.
That would be great.
Fantastic. Thank you both very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we have some signed copies available in the official Time Team shop while stocks last. Last time, Derek visited Bournemouth University's Summer Field School, where students have been honing their skills on an Iron Age settlement as part of the Dura Truges Big Dig.
The last 6 weeks, we've been excavating a large, what's known as a banjo enclosure. It's an elite farmstead, really existed about 300 to 100 BC. We've got storage pits everywhere. We've got roundhouses.
We're picking up on that story now, back in the lab with their colleagues, Harry Manley and Megan Russell, to discover what happens to all the finds.
We're here back at Bournemouth University, and I'm going to show you something we don't normally get to see on an excavation. It's a post-excavation process, and I'm joined by Megan, our processing manager, to talk us through what we get up to after the dig is finished. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Harry.
So what are we up to here then?
So this is where all of our finds come in, straight from the dig. So
there's quite a lot of them.
There is. We obviously aim to process all of our finds on site, but yep. That of course is not realistic due to the sheer number of finds that we get. So this is where they all end up. We've got some nice, we've got a dog burial here. We've got a lot of samples that still need to be processed. Lots of pottery, lots of microfauna.
So this is washed and unwashed finds?
Yeah, almost all of this is completely unwashed, unrecorded, but we've got some nice stuff that has been washed. And over here, this is where the washed finds get processed and get recorded on the register.
Fantastic. I can see some nice pot here, some sort of black burnish ware with holes in the bottom. Is that usual or unusual?
Yes. So this is actually really typical of what we get. We have a lot of pot that has been fired and then has secondary drilled holes in the bases. So it wasn't their primary use, but actually then perhaps the rim has broken off. Whatever the primary use was for it has, it's not useful anymore. So actually then they go, we use it for something else, like
recycling,
like a flower pot.
Yeah, fantastic. And what really strikes me actually is the sheer wealth of finds we're getting, because when I'm in the trench, you just see a snapshot of it. But when you're back here, it's like, God, right. We dug a lot.
Absolutely.
And what's Ruby doing over in the corner there?
So over here, Ruby is processing our microfauna. So this has been sieved at different levels, and she's just sorting through to pick out our really smallest bones.
From voles and frogs and toads.
Yeah, insectivores, hedgehogs, things like that. And these are really interesting to us because they can show us what has happened to the pit. So if it's been left open, have things like frogs fallen in and then got stuck inside the pit. So it tells us that pit has been left open for a period of time, etc.
So we can get a really good understanding of the site as it develops and as it goes out of use.
Absolutely, yeah, it definitely tells us about disuse.
Fantastic, sure. So we've got a bit of a site history. And this over here, this is almost like a who's who or what's what of pots here, isn't it? This is incredible.
Yes.
Such a good range of things going on. And oh, this is nice. Tell us about this.
So this is our worked antler. And we're not sure about the use, but there, as you can see, there's lots of perforated holes and it's been sawn off. So it's obviously something. Yeah. We've never seen anything like this before.
This is amazing. I love all the cut marks on it as well, not just a decoration on there. Fantastic. So is that antler, did you say?
It is, yes, antler.
Brilliant. I won't move too much because...
can see me getting nervous.
Yeah, and also I'll put it back in the wrong tray. Well, thanks, Megan. We'll leave you and Ruby to get on with this. And hopefully we'll see Time Team back in Dorset soon.
Thank you both. It looks like you've got your work cut out for you there.
Welcome back to Cornwall, a return to the Bowden Iron Age Fugu on the Lizard Peninsula. Orientating a maze of country lanes is Time Team's Matt Bear Clark, 3D finds and historical reconstruction artist.
Hello from the new excavation here in Bedin.
And hello from me.
Hello.
So I expect you want to know what's happened since we were last here.
You've got a bigger hole.
Well, you've got a much bigger hole. You can probably see that we've excavated this really nice section through the ditch. It's incredibly sharply angled, and it results in what we might term as a bit of an ankle breaker. You can see this channel along the bottom. You really wouldn't want to rush along there because you're going to end up breaking your legs. It's more the kind of thing you might see in a Roman fort. It's not a Roman fort because we know that it's dated to around about 400 BC, so that's firmly in the Iron Age. But what we have exposed, if you remember back when John Gator did that little bit of geophys to see whether we could connect ditch to the exposed void, as we were calling it, the hole.
So the hole was here.
The hole was there, but it didn't take us long to start exposing the sides of a cut leading away from the ditch, this enclosure ditch. It just extends that far. There's a great big capstone there. There's a nice lintel there, and it's got stone sides to it, so it's stone walled. But what we've got here, we can imagine, must be part of the intact Fugu from 400 BC.
It's a very tight entrance.
If you were to run out of there in a hurry,
you're not going,
and you wouldn't know which way to go. You're not going to get up there, and you're unlikely to get up there because there'll be a big rampart in your way. So if you were invading and this was blocked off in some way, there's no way you'd get out of this ditch.
The new discoveries at Bowden could not have been made if not for the tireless efforts for James and the volunteers of Meneag. Set up in 2008 by James, the group have continued investigating the mysterious Iron Age Fugu and adjoining Bronze Age settlement, with a few Roman discoveries along the way. Time for Bear to take a look inside a very windy finds tent.
We've got a spindle well here used to create thread, maybe wool, and that twisted thread can then be woven into cloth on a loom.
Other finds include this Treviska ware lug with twisted cord decoration. This whetstone was discovered within the Fugu, and it still bears some of the iron residue from the knives sharpened on its smooth surface. A sherd of cooking pot. Lastly, a beautiful blue glass bead, likely from some exquisite Iron Age jewellery. Last on the agenda, Bear scans for Fugu with plans to update the digital historical reconstruction as seen in the main episode. This will include the newly discovered entry passageway and tunnel walls, bringing Time Team's understanding of the Fugu bang up to date.
We like to see what's happening in archaeology all around the world, and this recent discovery caught our eye from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico in the Caba Archaeological Zone. In preparation for a new railway route, the National Institute of Anthropology and History have identified two previously unknown pre-Columbian residential complexes, including a huge structure described as a palace. The buildings have been provisionally dated to about 1,500 years ago, around 500 AD. The city of Caba, which means Lord of the Strong or Powerful Hand in the Mayan dialect, is a well-known archaeological site and a popular tourist spot. Caba's most recognised building is the Palace of the Masks, so called because of the intricate, beautifully crafted relief work on its walls. The faces with a distinctive elongated nose are said to represent the rain god Charc. However, the newly discovered buildings are of particular interest because of their residential nature. Now, according to the official statement, this is the first time that there's a record of ancient homes inside this Mayan site. One of these buildings is especially impressive. It's 26 metres in length, with a main facade composed of a portico with 8 pilasters and 9 openings. The structure would have been decorated with carvings of feathers, birds and beads. Now you might wonder that such a large structure with huge stonework still in situ has only recently come to attention. However, as the reports highlight, there were already indirect notions of these complexes within the settlement, but they'd until recently been covered in dense vegetation. What an incredible discovery. One of the things we often get asked about on Time Team is what happened next, what happened after Time Team had filmed an episode. And I'm very lucky here to be joined by Philippa Walton, who was one of the leads at Piercebridge, an excavation that Time Team did back in 2010. Philippa, hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, back in 2010, I invited Time Team to come along to a site I've been working on with two divers. So on the River Tees at Piercebridge, these two divers, Bob and Rolf, had been looking in the river for bits of a Roman bridge. And while they were diving, they started finding hundreds of Roman artifacts. They just kept pulling out finger rings, brooches, military equipment, horse harness, knives, just you think of any Roman object type, and they were finding it. And I really wanted to contextualise what was happening in the river. So I asked Time Team to come along, do some geophysics, do a little bit of diving and snorkeling, and they kindly obliged, came along and helped me out, trying to get an idea of why those objects were on the riverbed.
Fantastic. So isn't this the one where all that thousands of pounds worth of geophysics equipment was being floated?
Yeah, in a dinghy, yes. It floated along the river nice and calmly on a dinghy for 2 days. And then we woke up on day three, and the very, very shallow River Tees had turned into this raging torrent.
So why are we getting all these objects in the riverbed? Obviously, you're saying, you know, there's a lot of occupation and there's a main Roman road going through. But is there any other reason? Are people just dropping stuff as they're going across the river?
So that's the one question I really wanted to answer. So I applied for a major research grant from the Leverhulme with Hella Eckhart at the University of Reading. And we worked on that for a whole 2 years. Wow. So we're thinking, why are these objects there on the riverbed? And what can we tell about the sorts of people who use those objects? You know, people just dropping stuff as they're crossing the river, like disposing of their rubbish? Or is this something a little bit more religious in nature? So a ritual element. So you cross a bridge, and when you cross a bridge, you make an offering to the god to make sure you're on your travels, that you're successful and that you come back alive. That's probably particularly important for people going up from York to the military frontier. Most of them are going to be soldiers. You've got thousands of Roman coins, so silver denarii and a full range of bronze coins, right through from the Iron Age all the way through to the 5th century. There are hundreds of brooches. There's even a finger ring which is engraved with the inscription which says, to the god Mars. So we're starting to think that maybe some of these objects were being offered to particular gods, and Mars is the god of war, so it's that the association with the Roman army. There was huge numbers of military belt fittings of particular types, and there were types that were used by soldiers who came from the Danubian areas of the empire, so you could start to see where these people were coming from.
What do you have any favourite find from there?
Oh, that's a really difficult one.
No, sorry.
So there's a beautiful little figurine of a ram. But the person, it's made out of bronze, and it's about that big. And the person who made the figurine, they must have seen a ram at some point in their life, but it just looks a bit cartoony, and he's got a very cute little face. So I quite like him. And also the ram is the symbol of the god Mercury. So again, it has that ritual religious association. And I was always really keen. I know archaeologists, if they don't understand anything, are always keen on saying it's ritual. But I always thought, from the very moment I saw this material from Piercebridge, that it was ritual, religiously motivated. It wasn't just rubbish. And that little figurine clearly points to that ritual element.
Wow. And so where are all these finds now?
So they were acquired under the Treasure Act, and the Museum of Archaeology at the University of Durham acquired the whole assemblage.
Wow.
And they've put on lots of exhibitions with their students at Durham University, which make use of the collections. So it's continuing to have impact. It's not just sitting in a museum store. People are working with it, reinterpreting the objects and putting on them on display for new audiences all the time.
That's fantastic. Congratulations, because that sounds like such a fabulous site to have been involved in.
Yeah, it's taken up nearly half of my career. I've spent more than 20 years of my life working on it. And now it's come to an end, I feel a little bit bereft, but I'm going to still keep doing little bits of research on it, I think, until I retire.
Thanks, Philippa. Thanks very much.
No problem at all.
Wow. Well, the Piercebridge episode is available to watch right now on the Time Team Classics YouTube channel. And if you'd like to discover more about the fascinating project, Philippa has co-authored a book, Bridge Over Troubled Water, along with Hella Eckhart, which you can access online for free. We've put the links for both in the description box below.
And finally, we've had some inspiring community archaeology projects this month, from Carenza's work through to Operation Nightingale. And I'd like to end this update with news of a community project from up north. Farmworth, near Bolton in northwest England. Bolton Council and local charity Banana Enterprise Network have been awarded National Lottery Heritage funding for their Rock Hall Revival project. The hall is a Grade 2 listed building that was built in 1807 by John Crompton II, whose family had owned paper mills in Lancashire since 1676, and they owned a nearby paper mill next to Rock Hall. John's son, Thomas, patented a paper drying process that revolutionised the paper making industry, and in its day, the mill supplied paper for many of London's newspapers. Now, whilst the mill was demolished in the 70s, Rock Hall survived and eventually went on to become a visitor centre and the base for the Crawl Irwell Valley Country Park Rangers. Sadly, in recent years, it's fallen into disrepair. But now the development stage of the new project promises to redevelop Rock Hall as a centre for the community and enhance the natural environment of Moses Gate Country Park. There'll be many opportunities for the community to get involved and engage with the area's important industrial heritage and green spaces. Congratulations to all involved. So those are just some of the stories that have caught my eye recently. But please do let us know your favourite archaeological discoveries or any items that you'd like us to include in the comments section below. You can find 3D models of the stories we've featured this month over on our Patreon channel. And if you'd like to see us do more excavations, you can help to make that happen by becoming a Patreon member. Not only do you get access to a range of additional extras such as Dig Watch and interviews and masterclasses, but your ongoing membership directly supports us to make more episodes. Please do remember to subscribe and press that like button. It really does make all the difference. So that's all from me for now. Thank you for bearing with me outside in the weather, and I look forward to seeing you next time.
Join Time Team on Patreon to access exclusive 3D models, masterclasses, and behind-the-scenes insights.